and held it fast. The room and its contents all vanished instantly, and they stood in the city streets upon a snowy Christmas morning. Scrooge and the ghost passed on, invisible, straight to Scrooge's clerk, and on the threshold of the door, the spirit smiled and stopped to bless Bob Cratchit's dwelling with the sprinklings of his torch. Then up rose Mrs. Cratchit, Cratchit's wife, dressed out but poorly in a twice-turned gown, but brave in ribbons, which are cheap and make a goodly show for sixpence. And she laid the cloth, assisted by Belinda Cratchit, the second of her daughters, also brave in ribbons, while Master Peter Cratchit plunged a fork into the saucepan of potatoes, and getting the corners of his monstrous shirt collar, it was Bob's private property conferred upon his son and heir in honor of the day, getting the corners into his mouth, rejoiced to find himself so gallantly attired, and yearned to show his linen in the fashionable parks. And now two smaller Cratchits, boy and girl, came tearing in, screaming that outside the baker's they had smelt the goose and known it for their own. And basking in luxurious thoughts of sage and onion, these young Cratchits danced about the table and exalted Master Peter Cratchit to the skies, while he blew the fire until the slow potatoes bubbling up knocked loudly at the saucepan lid to be let out and peeled. "Has ever got into your precious father, then?" said Mrs. Cratchit. "And your brother Tiny Tim and Martha weren't so late last Christmas by half an hour. Here's Martha, mother," said a girl, appearing as she spoke. "Here's Martha, mother," cried the two young Cratchits. "There's such a goose, Martha!" "My bless your heart alive, my dear, how late you are." Mrs. Cratchit kissed her a dozen times and took off her shawl and bonnet for her. "We'd a great deal of work to finish up last night," replied the girl, "and we had to clear away this morning, mother." "Well, never mind, so long as you're come. Sit ye down before the fire, my dear, and have a warm, Lord bless ye." No, there's father coming," said the little Cratchit. "Hide, Martha, hide." So Martha hid herself, and in came little Bob, the father, with at least 3 feet of comforter, exclusive of the fringe, hanging down before him, and his threadbare clothes darned up and brushed to look seasonable, and Tiny Tim upon his shoulder. Alas for Tiny Tim, he bore a little crutch and had his limbs supported by an iron frame. "Where's Martha?" cried Bob Cratchit, looking round. "Not coming," said Mrs. Cratchit. "Not coming," said Bob, with a sudden declension in his high spirits, for he'd been Tim's blood horse all the way home from church and had come home rampant. "Not coming, and upon Christmas Day." Martha didn't like to see him disappointed, if it were only in a joke, so she came out prematurely from behind the closet door and ran into his arms while the two young Cratchits hustled Tiny Tim and bore him off to the wash house that he might hear the pudding singing in the copper. His active little crutch was heard upon the floor as back came Tiny Tim, escorted by his brother and sister to his stool beside the fire, and while Bob turning up his cuffs, as if, poor fellow, they were capable of being made more shabby, compounded some hot mixture in a jug with gin and lemons, and stirred it round and round and put it on the hob to simmer, Master Peter and the two ubiquitous young Cratchits went to fetch the goose, with which they soon returned in high procession. Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy, ready beforehand in a little saucepan, hissing hot. Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigor. Miss Belinda sweetened up the applesauce. Martha dusted the hot plates. Bob took Tiny Tim beside him in a tiny corner at the table. The two young Cratchits set chairs for everybody, not forgetting themselves, and mounting guard upon their posts, crammed spoons into their mouths lest they should shriek for goose before their turn came. At last the dishes were set on and grace was said. It was succeeded by a breathless pause as Mrs. Cratchit, looking slowly all along the carving knife, prepared to plunge it in the breast. But when she did, and when the long-expected gush of stuffing issued forth, One murmur of delight arose all round the board, and even Tiny Tim, excited by the two young Cratchits, beat upon the table with the handle of his knife and feebly cried hurrah. There never was such a goose. Bob said he didn't believe there ever was such a goose cooked. Its tenderness and flavor, its size and cheapness were the themes of universal admiration. Eked out by applesauce and mashed potatoes, it was a sufficient dinner for the whole family. Indeed, as Mrs. Cratchit said with great delight, surveying one small atom of bone upon the dish, they hadn't ate it all at last. Yet everyone had had enough, and the young Cratchits in particular were steeped in sage and onion to the eyebrows. But now, the plates being changed by Miss Belinda, Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone, too nervous to bear witness, to take the pudding up and bring it in. Great deal of steam. Pudding was out of the copper. Smell like a washing day. That was the cloth. Smell like an eating house and a pastry cook's next door to each other, with a laundress's next door to that. That was the pudding. In half a minute, Mrs. Cratchit entered, flushed but smiling proudly, with the pudding like a speckled cannonball, so hard and firm, blazing in half a quartern of ignited brandy and bedight with Christmas holly stuck on the top. Oh, a wonderful pudding! Bob Cratchit said, and calmly too, that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit since their marriage. Mrs. Cratchit said that now that the weight was off her mind, she would confess she had had her doubts about the quantity of the flour. Everybody had something to say about it, but nobody said or thought it was at all a small pudding for a large family. Any Cratchit would have blushed to hint at such a thing. At last the dinner was all done. The cloth was cleared, the hearth swept and the fire made up, the compound in the jug being tasted and considered perfect. Apples and oranges were put upon the table and a shovelful of chestnuts on the fire. Then all the Cratchit family drew round the hearth in what Bob Cratchit called a circle, and at Bob Cratchit's elbow stood the family display of glass, two tumblers and a custard cup without a handle. These held the hot stuff from the jug, however, as well as golden goblets would have done. And Bob served it out with beaming looks while the chestnuts on the fire spluttered and crackled noisily. And then Bob proposed a Merry Christmas to us all, my dears. God bless us. Which all the family re-echoed. God bless us, everyone, said Tiny Tim, the last of all. He sat very close to his father's side upon a little stool. Bob held his withered little hand in his, as if he loved the child and wished to keep him by his side and dreaded that he might be taken from him. Scrooge raised his head speedily on hearing his own name. Mr. Scrooge, said Bob, I give you Mr. Scrooge, the founder of the feast.
The founder of the feast, indeed, cried Mrs. Cratchit, reddening. I wish I had him here. I'd give him a piece of my mind to feast upon, and I hope he'd have a good appetite for it.
My dear, said Bob, children, Christmas Day.
It should be Christmas Day, I'm sure, on which one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy, hard-on-feeling man as Mr. Scrooge. You know he is, Robert. Nobody knows it better than you do, poor fellow.
My dear, Christmas Day.
Now I'll drink his health for your sake and the day's, not for his. Long life to him, a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. He'll be very merry and very happy, I have no doubt.
The children drank the toast after her. It was the first of their proceedings that had no heartiness in it. Tiny Tim drank it last of all, but he didn't care a tuppence for it. Scrooge was the ogre of the family. The mention of his name cast a dark shadow on the party, which was not dispelled for full 5 minutes. After it had passed away, they were 10 times merrier than before from the mere relief of Scrooge the baleful being done. They were not a handsome family. They were not well dressed. Their shoes were far from being waterproof. Their clothes were scanty. And Peters might have known, and very likely did, the inside of a pawnbroker's. But they were happy, grateful, pleased with one another, and contented with the time. And when they faded and looked happier yet in the bright sprinklings of the spirit's torch at parting, Scrooge had his eye upon them, and especially on Tiny Tim, until the last. It was a great surprise to Scrooge as this scene vanished to hear a hearty laugh. It was a much greater surprise to Scrooge to recognize it as his own nephew's, and to find himself in a bright, dry, gleaming room with the spirit standing smiling by his side and looking at that same nephew. The nephew and his friends were playing 20 questions, a game called Yes and No, where Scrooge's nephew had to think of something and the rest must find out what. He only answering to their questions yes or no. The fire of questioning to which he was exposed elicited from him that he was thinking of an animal. A live animal. Rather a disagreeable animal. A savage animal. An animal that growled and grunted sometimes, and talked sometimes, and lived in London, and walked about the streets, and wasn't made a show of, and wasn't led by anybody, and didn't live in a menagerie, and was never killed in a market, and was not a horse, or an ass, or a cow, or a bull, or a tiger, or a dog, or a pig, or a cat, or a bear. And at every question put to him, the nephew burst into a fresh roar of laughter and was so inexpressibly tickled that he was obliged to get up off the sofa and stand. At last, the plump sister cried out, "I found it out. I know what it is, Fred. I know what it is." "What is it?" "It's your Uncle Scrooge." Which it certainly was. Admiration was the universal sentiment, though some objected that the reply to, "Is it a bear?" should have been yes. Scrooge looked about him for the ghost. He saw it no more. As the last stroke ceased to vibrate, he remembered the prediction of old Jacob Marley, and lifting his eyes, beheld a solemn phantom draped and hooded, coming like a mist along the ground towards him. The phantom slowly, gravely, silently approached. When it came near him, Scrooge bent down upon his knee, for in the air through which this spirit moved, it seemed to scatter gloom and mystery. It was shrouded in a deep black garment, which concealed its head, its face, its form, and left nothing of it visible save one outstretched hand. He knew no more. For the spirit neither spoke nor moved. "I'm in the presence of the ghost of Christmas yet to come. Ghost of the future. I fear you more than any specter I've seen. But as I know your purpose is to do me good, and as I hope to live to be another man from what I was, I prepare to bear you company. And do it with a thankful heart. Will you not speak to me?" Gave him no reply. The hand was pointed straight before them. "Lead on. Lead on. The night is waning fast, and it's precious time to me, I know. Lead on, spirit." It scarcely seemed to enter the city, for the city rather seemed to spring up about them. But there they were in the heart of it, on change among the merchants. The spirit stopped beside one little knot of businessmen. Observing that the hand was pointed to them, Scrooge advanced to listen to their talk. "No," said a great fat man with a monstrous chin. "I don't know much about it either way. I only know he's dead." "When did he die?" inquired another. "Last night, I believe. What's the matter with him?" "I thought he'd never die." "God knows at the first." "What's he done with his money?" Haven't heard. Company, perhaps. Hasn't left it to me. That's all I know. Goodbye.
Scrooge looked about in the very place for his own image, but another man stood in his accustomed corner, and though the clock pointed to his usual time of day for being there, he saw no likeness of himself among the multitudes that poured in through the porch. It gave him little surprise, however, for he'd been revolving in his mind a change of life, and he thought and hoped he saw his newborn resolutions carried out in this. They left the busy scene and went into an obscure part of town, to a low shop where iron, old rags, bottles, bones, and greasy offal were bought. A gray-haired rascal of great age sat smoking his pipe. Scrooge and the Phantom came into the presence of this man, just as a woman with a heavy bundle slunk into the shop. But she was scarcely entered when another woman, similarly laden, came in too. And she was closely followed by a man in faded black. After a short period of blank astonishment, in which the old man with the pipe had joined them, they all three burst into a laugh. "Let the charwoman alone to be the first," cried she who had entered first. "Let the laundress alone to be the second, and let the undertaker's man alone to be the third. Look here, old Joe, here's a chance. If we haven't all three met here without meaning it."